was made this week in the final hours before a vote planned for tomorrow on the American Health Care Act, or the AHCA, the would-be replacement for the Affordable Care Act, has had trouble gaining enough Republican support to pass. Some of the holdouts were Republicans in parts of New York State, and that's where our connection comes in. Congressman Chris Collins and John Faso put together a deal that would transfer the bulk of Medicaid costs from county governments to the New York State government. With this deal in place, Collins and Faso, along with other GOP colleagues, say they can now support the AHCA. For these Republicans, this move fixes a 51-year mistake. Other states, they say, don't shift the cost of Medicaid to counties, and the GOP argues that by doing that, New York State has forced property taxes to soar. But on Tuesday, Governor Andrew Cuomo blasted this deal, saying it declares war on New York State. He said the deal would result in New Yorkers losing health care, losing Medicaid, and he warned that the state doesn't have at least $2.3 billion, maybe more, to simply plug into maintaining Medicaid. New York State's Medicaid director, Jason Helgerson, said the updated version of the AHCA would take health care away from 2.7 million New Yorkers. Now, you've had plenty of questions about the AHCA. We're going to do our best to address what we do know and what we don't so far. So let me go ahead and welcome my guests as I try to get out of the way the best I can, because we have Karen Chikurji here, WXXI health reporter and producer, who's done a wonderful job covering these issues for us. So thank you for being here with us this hour, Karen.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also with us is Jane Dodds, a fellow with the American College of Medical Practice Executives. Jane, nice to see you back here.
Thanks, Evan.
Deborah Shapit is a grant writer at the Anthony Jordan Health Center. Deborah, welcome to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Christopher Bell is executive director of the Monroe County Medical Society, the American Academy of Pediatrics NY1, and the Genesee Valley Medical Foundation. Chris, welcome to you as well.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
We're kind of by the seat of our pants here, so I just want to tell everybody, make sure you get nice and close to your microphones as well there, so we can hear you well. On the phone, we have Dr. Sarah Liebschutz, who is a Distinguished Service Professor Emerita at the College at Brockport. Sarah, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us. We'll hear her in just a second, I'm sure. Okay, Karen, let me just start with you. Let's take a kind of a broad overview. I know our listeners will have questions, but there's a lot that's been happening even in the last 24 hours. What's the broad overview of where things stand right now as we head into tomorrow's possible vote on this?
Well, in terms of the latest, what we have is a major shift specifically for New York State, which would take basically all the money that counties chip in, not excluding, we're not talking about New York City in terms of a change, we're talking about all the other counties in the state, and would basically say, okay, like now this is all about the state. Now this is about the state's responsibility. We're going to be out about $2.3 billion, and the state would have to make that up, in addition to all of the dollars that are estimated to potentially disappear with the AHCA.
Okay.
To the state.
And the biggest outstanding questions, I guess, are, you know, if it is going to go ahead and get the 214 votes it needs tomorrow, and then what New York State would be doing about this, right? What other outstanding questions do we have?
Well, I think...
I know we don't have the whole hour to just list all the questions.
Yeah, a lot of questions. I mean, I think that, in addition to that, which is obviously really would be huge for New York State, there are some just fundamental major changes in terms of the AHCA from the ACA and how that would also impact New York State. Do you want to talk about that first?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So we have this biggest change, I think, which is the switch over from individual mandate, or otherwise known as needing to buy health insurance or you will get a penalty, switching over to this idea of a penalty if you don't have continuous coverage. Mm-hmm. And the way that is being stated right now is if you have a break in coverage for more, I believe, than 63 days.
63 days.
I don't know what the significance of that number is or how it was chosen, but 63 days, then you will get a... If you want to go back into the marketplace and get health insurance, say you've lost your job, or say your house broke down, need to fix it all again, or all of a sudden you have all these other payments that you need to account for, you will be hit with a 30% surcharge on your premium monthly.
Okay. For 12 months.
For up to a year. So that's pretty big. And so in some ways, that's kind of the other side of what we've been talking about in terms of the individual mandate. They're saying, okay, this is going to be our version of that in some ways in terms of financial incentive to get people to sign up for health insurance.
But to make sure we're clear on this, under the Affordable Care Act, The individual mandate is if you don't buy insurance, you don't have insurance, you can be penalized.
Correct.
Whereas under the AHCA,
right,
you would not be penalized for not having insurance. It's
no.
just that once you want to get insurance,
correct,
if you've been 63 days or more without it, then you're going to be hit with a surcharge.
Correct.
And a lot of the concern I'm hearing is,
yep,
well, if let's say you're a young, healthy person,
right,
and it's been 90 days or more, let's say it's been 900 days, whatever it's been,
right,
and you go, I don't want to pay a 30% surcharge, I will continue to go without insurance.
Right. And I think that that's what a lot of people are now saying, well, let's look at the implications of that choice. And the implications of that choice could be that you have lots of young, healthy people, maybe they're in college, maybe they're not, you know, people who'd say, well, I'm doing pretty much okay right now, you know, and
young people are invincible, as we know.
Of course we all are. Yes, yes, yes. Sarah, I hear you now. That's great.
Yeah.
So this idea that healthy people might not be signing up for health insurance, which creates all kinds of issues,
yep,
perhaps most importantly, that premiums might increase. So that's the individual mandate issue. And then another one, of course, which is the Medicaid block grants.
We're going to get to that in a second.
Great.
Let me ask each of our guests, and I'll start with Dr. Liebschutz, who's on the line with us, again, a distinguished service professor emerita at the College at Brockport. I'll ask all of our guests, as you look at what we do know and maybe some of what we're still learning about the AHCA, what stands out to you as either a bug or a feature? Sarah, I'll start with you.
Okay, well, I would start by saying that there are two ways of thinking about health care. One is that to invest in it by governments with subsidies, et cetera, reflects the view that health care is good for society. That's a sort of investment in health care. The other approach has been called a piggy bank view, namely, we must cut health care spending in order to cut taxes. So I think that in a way, the AHCA, it tries to combine both of these approaches, and I understand, actually, that it neither satisfies the conservative Republicans nor the moderate Republicans. So, I mean, there are lots I could say about these specific aspects of the act. I hope we're going to talk during the program about this enticement to upstate Republicans, mm-hmm, to vote for the act before the program is over, because I do have something to say about that.
You're referring to what some in the media are referring to as the Buffalo bribe. And
so catchy.
It's a catchy name for it. I mean,
yeah,
there are,
yeah,
deal sweeteners, by the way, in a lot of different deals. A lot of people are comparing it to the Cornhusker kickback.
Right.
Another catchy name that helped pass the ACA. But, you know, I just got a note from a listener who's pointing out several other states do require counties to pay portions of Medicaid. The Collins Amendment only targets New York.
And that is a very important point, Evan. I think there are 16 other states that require local governments to contribute to the non-federal share of Medicaid. And there's a second point I would make, and that is that it used to be that the federal share of total Medicaid spending in New York was 50%, with the state government providing 25% and local governments 25%. Now, because the state has assumed totally the non-federal share of long-term care, which is a big component of Medicaid spending, counties pay 13%. I also think, and you know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm just a professor, but I think that this may be an unconstitutional kind of sweetener. And I think that that New York State, having been singled out here, could say that this violates the 10th Amendment. And you know, for the federal government to tell the state how to manage its finances, I think goes over the line here.
Well, one person who disagrees, Sarah, is Congressman Tom Reed. You might have heard him on Morning Edition this morning. I want to listen to some of Congressman Reed's comments about this deal sweetener,
okay,
that he thinks could help. Let's listen.
Sure. What we have seen traditionally is the state try to pass those costs at some point in time onto the local governments and our property taxpayers. And with this provision, I think it's very clear to the state capitol that you can no longer do that. And again, standing up for our property taxpayers in New York, standing up for our seniors, and standing up for those disabled communities that are going to benefit from the additional changes that we have made.
All right, so Sarah, Tom Reed is saying good for taxpayers. Chris Collins told Politico, if the governor is so incompetent he can't find a few billion dollars more in his budget, that he can call his office and he'll help. So they're digging in politically on this one. So some final thoughts from you on that, Sarah?
Well, I am aware of the history of this, and I know that especially New York City is not exempt in this legislation, in this proposed legislation, this sweetener. This reflects a bias against New York City, which pays more than its fair share of state taxes in revenues to the state. I would make one other point, and I've talked over the long years that I've done research on Medicaid, that some local Medicaid directors say it's not a bad thing that we pay part of the cost of Medicaid, because that gives us leverage in terms of decision-making about who's eligible, what programs, what services will be eligible for Medicaid. So I have clearly a different view on this.
All right, let's continue to go around the table. Jane Dodds, next up. Jane, thoughts on what you've seen so far from the AHCA. Jane's a fellow with the American College of Medical Practice Executives.
Well, thanks, Evan. I've been doing medical practice management for over 30 years, and under the Affordable Care Act, as it was originally passed, essentially we had a three-legged stool. The first, we guaranteed that everybody was going to have insurance. In return for that, the insurance companies guaranteed that they would sell insurance to anybody who wanted it. And the third thing was that we would provide assistance for people who couldn't afford that insurance. Mm-hmm. So what the president did on Inauguration Day was to remove the impetus for purchasing insurance by saying that they wouldn't enforce an individual mandate. Now, I'll be very curious to see if any insurance companies are willing to sell insurance in this uncertain market. They don't know who they're going to be selling insurance to. So we already know that 19 states didn't accept the Medicaid expansion. Their governors are complaining that they have a limited number of insurance carriers in those markets because they don't have the market. They don't have the customers buying insurance or the subsidies available to purchase insurance. So the issue for me is, I want to see what insurance plans are going to be available. Even in New York, where we're very well protected by our state insurance department, mm-hmm. we're not sure what plans are going to be available because we don't know who's going to be required to have insurance and who's going to be able to go without.
Jane, does that uncertainty of what is going to be available and who's sort of involved, does that reflect a lack of planning, a lack of transparency? What's the concern there that you have on that?
I think it's a lack of understanding on the part of the legislators who are trying to craft this plan. Shockingly, healthcare is complicated. And I think they underestimated, I mean, when they talk about the government forcing people to buy insurance that they don't want, I'd like to know which of the 10 points of the Affordable Care Act people don't want. I mean, the Affordable Care Act required that anybody who sold insurance on the marketplace it's been that way in New York all along, has to cover hospitalization, has to cover preventive care, has to cover maternity care, has to cover medications. If we go back to the days when insurance companies were allowed to sell shoddy products in other states, then people will be buying something and assuming they've got coverage when in fact they don't, mm-hmm. which was a problem that was remedied by the Affordable Care Act. I work in an OBGYN practice right now. Our patients are primarily covered. You know, preventive care is covered. Contraceptive care is covered. We've noticed over the last 7 years that the rate of unintended pregnancy and the abortion rates have gone down. Abortion is now at the lowest rate it's been since 1973, and we thank the Affordable Care for that because nationwide people have had access to good contraception. So, you know, it's going to have long, unintended consequences if we pull that rug out from under people.
All right. Deb is a grant writer with Anthony Jordan Health Center, and I want to ask Deb now for your thoughts as we look ahead to the AHCA.
So Anthony Jordan Health Center is a federally qualified health center, and we are federally qualified health centers were established, I think, in the late 60s to assure that all low-income people, regardless of insurance status, particularly those in medically underserved areas, had access to comprehensive primary care. 70% of our patients are on Medicaid. So the big thing that we are looking at right now is the potential loss of billions of dollars in Medicaid funding and what that's going to mean to our ability to care for our patients and to provide them with the quality of care that keeps them out of the emergency department for things like strep throats. So when our providers are completely booked up because we've got sort of a perfect storm of a lot more patients, we're required to serve all patients regardless of ability to pay. So we're looking at a little bit of a perfect storm of seeing a lot more patients who are losing Medicaid, who are potentially losing for those that are on the exchange, losing the exchange. At the same time, we have a pool of money called 330 money that we get to specifically to serve uninsured people and to provide services that are not reimbursed by Medicaid and things like that. We are looking at a 70% cut in those funds. So we may be looking at many more patients that coming to our doors and a lot less fewer resources to serve those people. The continuous coverage was the other thing that even with the ACA, our facilitated enrollers predicted, it's going to be a problem for people who are living not just paycheck to paycheck, but the paycheck doesn't actually last the whole 2 weeks or whatever. And they have to make a choice between paying their health insurance premium and fixing the car so they can get to work or paying the babysitter or whatever. There's a fair amount of churning. And if they are then going to have to pay an even higher rate to get back on insurance, they're not going to get insured. They're going to go to the emergency room. I ran some sort of back of the envelope numbers, and our cost to care for a patient, giving, you know, comprehensive primary care, the kinds of things that keep people off dialysis and, you know, very expensive treatments. So our cost is about $1,000 per year, full year, per patient. One single emergency department visit is easily going to run, I've seen estimates between $1,400 and $2,400 as an average. That was just a Google search, so. We're going to pay for health care one way or the other. I guess that's my message to the people in the counties who are laboring currently under the illusion that they're going to get their property tax bill is all of a sudden going to be lower as a result of, what are we calling it, the Buffalo bribe.
The Buffalo bribe.
I've also heard Manhattan transfer, so a couple of things.
The Tammany Hall, H-A-U-L, that's clever. But the bottom line is, even if we see property taxes go down, you're saying that taxpayers are going to pay for this in other ways.
In other ways. I mean, yeah. People are, unless we literally, and we don't. I think, I tend to believe that the American people do want to see everybody have health care. The argument is about who's going to pay for it. And it sort of becomes a not in my backyard.
Okay.
And I guess I would advise those folks also to take that $350 that Tom Reed has said they will save on their property taxes and be thinking about purchasing long-term care insurance, because a lot of people think that they're never going to need Medicaid, but many of them are, or their elderly family members are. So,
well, that's for starters. I know Deb's got a lot more to say on the subject. I'll turn to Christopher Bell, who's the executive director of the Monroe County Medical Society. Christopher, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you. You know, my biggest concern in my approach to this piece of legislation is really about the patients in our communities and ensuring that they continue to have access to high quality and affordable health care. There are a lot of changes that are proposed to the Medicaid program, specifically in the AHCA. And one thing that specifically concerns me is that there's a risk in my mind, and based on the CBO estimates and many other estimates, that the historic high 98% of children in New York State that currently have coverage under Medicaid and the CHIP program are going to be at risk of maintaining that coverage. That to me is a concerning factor. Something that I know that Our legislators are proposing that is mitigated throughout the bill, but something that I still have some concerns with.
A listener says, ironic that Collins and Faso and Tom Reed are talking about dictating New York state policy while Paul Ryan touts the increased federalism of the AHCA to give states more control of block grants. Let me just say this about federalism and judicial activism. That's two categories where you are for it when it does something you like and you are against it when it doesn't. Now, there are purists when it comes to federalism, and there are purists when it comes to judicial activism. But for the most part, whatever side you're on, if a judge is an activist in a way that you like activism, and if not, you don't. Same thing with federalism. You want more state control on issues where you like it, and more federal control when you don't. And this is an example of some of that. All I'm saying is the listener who writes makes a good point here. For all the GOP talks about giving states more control, yes, the Collins, Faso, Reed addition to the AHCA targeting just New York State on how we pay for Medicaid definitely runs against that, but it supports what they want to do, so they support it. We've got just about every phone line filled up here. If you want to jump in on the AHCA, we're going to be doing that in our second half hour. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. It's 263-9994. I'll grab our first call, and it's Don in East Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What I don't understand is why the Republicans hate the Affordable Care Act so much, because it's a Republican plan. It was developed by a group, the American Enterprise Institute. It was unrolled in Massachusetts by a Republican governor named Mitt Romney. In fact, we should call it Romney Care. What's not to like? It shovels fistfuls of federal money into private enterprise, the insurance companies, and the affordable, the individual mandate part of it, they don't even understand their own capitalist economic system. If you tell an insurance company that they've got to accept pre-existing conditions, which they're going to lose a lot of money on, you got to give them something in return for that. That was the individual mandate. The Republicans cannot come up with an alternative to the Affordable Care Act because it's a Republican idea. The only thing that would be better than the Affordable Care Act is universal single-payer health plan. But they don't want that. But this is a Republican plan. Obama probably copied it from the Republicans in order to get them on board back in 2010. Remember, that was his, when he was in his bipartisan phase.
Don, and I got to jump in here. The Affordable Care Act can trace its roots to Romney Care. The Heritage Foundation liked parts of it. The individual mandate was all about accountability and responsibility back in the 1990s before it became anathema to conservative causes. Yes, there are conservative roots in the ACA, and I think Don's just making the point that this feels all very political. And maybe it is. I think a lot of people share that. Jane, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I'd like to point out that the whole concept of patient deductibles was introduced by Republicans in order to make sure that patients had more skin in the game. And so originally, you know, back in the day, you used to have a $5 copay or a $15 copay at your doctor's office. Now they've switched it to a patient deductible, which when it was $1,000 was one thing. But now that it gets up to $6,000 or $13,000 for a family, it does become unaffordable. But that was originally implemented to make sure that patients had some skin in the game and that they would become smart shoppers and smart consumers. My take on that is that, yeah, deductibles are high, but generally people don't go bankrupt over a deductible. They used to go bankrupt over health care costs when they had no insurance. And the bottom line is, once your deductible is met or you've run up that much in service, even if you still owe it to a doctor or a hospital, the rest of your care is covered. So if you dump your motorcycle and fracture your pelvis, it's going to get covered, and your rehab is going to be covered because you may still owe some money for your deductible, but the rest of it is covered. And I think people, particularly the Republican legislators who are railing against high deductibles now, don't understand that the rest of the costs are still being covered.
Okay, let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back and we'll reset things for you as we're talking about the American Health Care Act, the AHCA, a vote scheduled for tomorrow, and could get done with the help of this late addition to the AHCA, thanks to some New York Republicans who want to transfer the cost of Medicaid take the county portion of that and give it back to New York State. And we've been talking about that among many other issues. We'll take more of your phone calls and get back with our panel after this short break. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with John Vito, a longtime local restaurateur, the best sandwich and soup and cookie maker in Rochester. He can't work as a restaurateur anymore because of kidney failure. He's a dialysis patient, and he has learned to cook for his kidneys. His new project is called exactly that, Cooking for Your Kidneys. It's a video series with recipes, and we'll talk about how he's doing it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our colleague Karen Shikurji is helping lead this hour, WXXI health reporter and producer who's been doing outstanding work on these kinds of issues. And there is going to be a lot to report on. In fact, you can probably look for the latest iterations of Karen's reporting on the AHCA in just the coming days before the end of this week.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you know, there's a lot of strands, and we're trying to kind of keep them together for you. Let me grab another phone call. This is Bill in Waterloo next. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Evan. I wanted to know what your panel thought were the actual real problems with the Affordable Care Act as it, you know, stands today. I have friends and family who are, they own private practices in the medical and the, you know, pharmacy industries, and they talk about how, while it solves a problem for someone like me who's self-employed, they take it on the chin financially.
Sure.
And they're not sure that long term that it's just financially feasible, that it still is spending more money than what's coming in, and they kind of blame the insurance companies for it. But I wanted to hear what an advocate of the program thinks are the real problems with it.
It's a great, Bill, thank you. I mean, it's probably its own discussion, and it's probably academic at this point because the Republicans who control Washington are going to get rid of it in one way or another. But if there's a short answer for this, I think we can be adults and say that if the Affordable Care Act stayed, of course there would be things to tinker with. Anytime you have a complex law like this, you've got to look back and try to figure out costs, premiums. There were a lot of concerns. So, Deb, real briefly, because I want to get back to the AHCA, but his question, I think, is a good one. So
yeah, I just want to jump in and say that one thing that I think that kind of gets neglected is we don't look at the ACA versus the group marketplace. So when we heard 22% increase in premiums average in the ACA, our insurer, Jordan Health, came to us with a 22% increase in group insurance. So it's not a question necessarily of ACA, not ACA, but how health insurance is working in this country and all. So just wanted to throw that out as a perspective.
Okay. And Sarah, is there a short answer for if we were keeping the ACA, what you would fix first?
Well, I would just say, just taking a slightly longer term view here, that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the ACA in 2014 when the marketplaces, state level and federal, were opened because the demand, the overload on the systems just didn't keep up with the technology. And there was a lot, you know, said at the beginning about that. But in New York, we've really been a model state. The technology was absolutely sufficient, wonderful leadership. And so the insurance marketplace in New York has worked very well. But there are problems. I think they were alluded to in the first hour with respect to insurance premiums rising. And part of that, it was also pointed out, is due to the fact that insurance companies rely on a varied market so that people who are in very good health and tend to be younger don't incur major health care costs. And that balances the those people older who have such costs. So the problem was that the expectations were not met. And so the marketplace wasn't varied enough, wasn't balanced enough. But I think we also have to ask ourselves, what's the purpose of insurance? Well, the purpose of insurance is to cover health care costs. And then you know, if that's the purpose of insurance companies, I mean, set aside the big salaries of CEOs of insurance companies, the fact is that We have to ask about why healthcare costs are rising. Pharmaceuticals are a big contributor to healthcare costs. It last time I looked, it took about $1 billion for a product to go from inception through all testing, through approval by the FDA, to finally getting to the marketplace. That's a very big cost. Research and development is a big part of pharmaceutical costs. And then there was always the other issue, which ironically has been, borne out in the reactions to insurance premiums increase. And that is that most consumers didn't have an idea, probably still don't have an idea, what real costs are. You get a bill from a doctor, it has one number on it, and then it's reduced because this is all the third-party payer, like Excellus will allow, or Medicare will allow. And finally, you get down to your own $20 copay. So you think, okay, this is not a big deal for me, $20 or even $100. So I think it's kind of complicated. But this has all been revealed now as people are seeing their premiums go up and they have to have higher deductibles. So I think that the insurance part of it can be tweaked. In fact, President Obama, in an article under his name, Barack Obama, in the Journal of American Medicine that appeared last summer, pointed to ways in which the Affordable Care Act should be tweaked. So there are problems, but I don't know that what we're getting now is a solution to those problems.
Well, let me turn to Karen Shukurji, our colleague, for what we haven't hit yet. And, mm-hmm. and we talked about this Medicaid deal, call it whatever you want. But even before that, there were questions about Medicaid block grants. What's going to happen and what the impact would be here?
Right.
Tell us
about that. This is another fundamental change when it comes to the AHCA, which is that now the way Medicaid works is it's an entitlement program. So if you make the cut, you get Medicaid. That's how it works. And that the funding comes from both the federal government and the state, and as we all now know for sure, the counties. And I think the thing that we all need to be aware of is that switching from an entitlement program to a block grant program basically means that, and I'm going to say this in really simple terms because this is how I have to kind of explain to myself, the federal government gives each state an allowance. It's a fixed allowance of money, and what that amount is going to be based on, unless I've missed something, I don't know how that amount will be calculated. So New York State gets an allowance, and Chris knows that, so you can say.
Yeah. Based on the AHCA, the cost will be calculated by taking a look at 2016 costs and then adjusting them. It'll be a per capita block grant,
okay,
as what's proposed, meaning that the federal government will give X number of dollars per number of people, so some amount of money that would be going towards the Medicaid spend. And their proposal is to increase that annually by the medical CPI plus 1%.
Okay. Do you want to?
That's right. That's correct. Yeah, all of that. Yep.
So the idea is that if that happens, if things shift dramatically because of some sort of economic situation, industry changing, outbreaks, a number of things, and you have a higher need for insurance in a state, then that can put the state in a tricky situation in terms of finding money to potentially make that cost up or not. But I think the idea is just that. On the one hand, you have this idea that okay, this is going to be great. You're going to give states more flexibility to do whatever they want with the allowance. But on the other hand, that leaves states with that specific amount of money.
Yeah, and I think a perfect example of where states might need that additional money are things like the opioid epidemic, mm-hmm. where we need substantially more resources going to treatment and prevention, but with the cap. Might be less. I mean, it's hard to predict exactly how that's going to play out. Would depend on what the state decides to do. But I'm not sure that it does give the states more flexibility.
Okay. Jane?
I think we've got a perfect example. You can look at the states that didn't accept the Medicaid expansion in the first place. Mm-hmm. There are 19 states out there. Small rural hospitals in those states are closing. You know, I think something that people often forget is that healthcare is 16% of this economy. That's jobs as well as, I mean, everybody looks at Medicaid money and thinks, oh, the Medicaid money is providing healthcare. It's providing healthcare because nurses are being paid, doctors are being paid, hospitals get money to pay the rent, the lab bills are being paid, the people who work in the hospitals who clean the floors and provide lunch for the, you know, in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. All of those people have jobs because we have patients who are actually paying their bills when they get their services. If we pull part of the funding for that out, then we may be victims of what's happening in many other states where they didn't take the Medicaid expansion. And hospitals are going out of business.
Mm-hmm. I'm also reading a release from the Elder Justice Committee of Metro Justice today, calling on Congressman Chris Collins and John Faso to withdraw the Medicaid Local Share Limited Amendment, which they've proposed. And in their release, they say, while Monroe County residents will save hundreds of dollars on their property tax bill, the 34 nursing homes in Rochester would receive less in Medicaid funding. Medicaid pays for more than 75% of costs for residents in nursing homes. There are approximately 5,000 beds in Monroe County. It's not clear whether the state would take over the cost that had been paid by the county. So it's just another example of some of the concerns that are being shared there. I'll grab another phone call. It's Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, a couple of things. One is, I wonder, when I talk to people about the health care, which I think should be a right, a lot of times I get the impression, this is average citizens, that people still don't realize that the current system that we have been focusing on is a profit system. That when you use the word a market, that's kind of synonymous for they get money. So both the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance people get quite a bit of money as a profit. So when things go up and down, that's a reflection of the profit. That's the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing I wanted to say has to do with what you just, well, another part of what you just read, and that is I worked for over 30 years with people with disabilities and doing community work. And I just want to stress that the fact that people in used to be institutionalized primarily for their care, that are people with disabilities, now are living in a variety of settings, in a family, in another community setting, getting recreation, program. I mean, it's still not met. There's like 2,000 people on a waiting list for a residence. However, that all those activities you can possibly think of are funded by Medicaid, all of them. And that has happened over a number of years because actually it's less expensive in the long run to have people living in a community setting with getting these supports and normal lives and everything than it is to continue institutional care, which may very well start increasing if we can't keep these programs up because these are very, very important programs. But I want to keep stressing when the senators from New York talk about saving, what is it, $360, that is like a spit compared to how much Medicaid is used and important it is for all these different programs, which could be in jeopardy or just not be able to add any more people to their programs. So let's not be tricked by some witchery that's being done by these other people who actually might not have even been before this, but now they all of a sudden want to be on the Trump bandwagon. I don't know if they're afraid of him or just they want to be part of the more save money and play games routine.
Bonnie, thanks for the phone call. Anybody want to jump in on that?
I want to say
yes, Sarah, go ahead.
That I think her comments were very, very good. I think that we tend to view Medicare as health care for people over 65 and Medicaid for poor people. And never the twain shall meet. But that's not true. One in five Medicare beneficiaries relies on Medicaid for the services not covered by Medicare, such as nursing home services. And so in New York, 26%, that's even higher than the national average, of Medicare enrollees are what are called dual low income enrollees. So there's really not this split. And when people have said, oh, don't touch my Medicare, there are lots of people on Medicare who also rely on Medicaid. And that's another ingredient in this pot of particularly affecting people who are low income, who need nursing home care, and in fact, affecting the nursing homes themselves because they can't live on air. They have to have sufficient revenues.
I've got a series of questions from a listener named Herman. He sent 9. I can't get through all 9, but why don't I read a few of them that Herman is wondering. He says, first of all, he said, would insurance companies be able to charge women a higher premium than men, as was the case before the ACA under this new health care law? I don't know the answer to that.
I'm not sure that they can change that in the budget reconciliation process because I'm not sure that it would have a budget impact. I haven't seen anything that's the case.
I'm wondering if he is referring to the complaint of some men. Why should they be paying for maternity care and prenatal care? Well, I could turn that around and say women could complain, why should women have to pay for services affected with dealing with prostate cancer? I mean, I think when you get into cherry picking what are basic services, you really run into trouble. So I just think from a practical point of view, this will not be overturned.
Okay, Jane?
Yeah, I don't think we are clear yet about what the new plan will require for insurance companies. They're telling us that the insurance companies will be able to sell plans that the American people want, not what the government demands, which I assume means that they're going to tweak the list of required covered services under the Affordable Care Act. And we know that in the past, insurance companies have been able to sell plans that don't cover lady parts. So
yeah, and the AHCA already for Medicaid has eliminated the essential benefits, which include things like prenatal care, mental health services. They are unable to do that on the marketplace with this budget reconciliation process. But I think most advocates are fully anticipating that they will eliminate that.
Herman's second question is, would the loss ratio rule be repealed, meaning that insurance companies are free to spend part of your premium dollar on executive salaries, bonuses, dividends, et cetera, without limit, and would no longer be required to issue refunds if less than 80% of the premium dollar is spent on medical claims? I don't know the answer. That's another one we don't know, right?
I don't know the answer to that, yeah.
Good question.
I actually do know that there is something in there that it used to be that they could not deduct more than $500,000 for a CEO salary, and that cap has been eliminated. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the loss ratio.
All right, and one more question from Herman, and Herman will get to the other 6 on a different day. He says, under the ACA, there was a minimum income threshold to be eligible for subsidies. Those living in states without the Medicaid expansion fell through the cracks if their income was below that threshold. Under the AHCA, would all who buy insurance on the private market be eligible for the tax credits, regardless of how low their income?
Well, from what I understand, there are no income adjustments that are going to be made when it comes to private insurance. It's going to be based on your age bracket.
Up to $75,000. So you will get a tax credit,
or $150 for
a household. A flat tax credit that is age based, so it goes up as you age, but it is capped at $75,000 or $150,000. So you're not going to have millionaires getting tax credits to buy insurance.
Okay. John writes to the program validating some of what Deb was saying earlier. He says, good afternoon. As regards to rising insurance and company premiums, our premiums were rising by 20% for many years before the Affordable Care Act. That's from John. Jane on a different Jane, not Jane Dodds, but Jane, one of our regular callers, is on the phone with us. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Evan, I'm one of those people that gets the dual benefit of Medicare and Medicaid, and it does help me with the vision and the dental, and some of it is a little bit bare bones already, but I'm lucky enough to have both. But what I want to ask is this thing I heard, I think it was yesterday, about we're going to get, I think it's tough guy rhetoric, you know, we're going to be tough guys, and I want the opinion of the panel, but what they're saying is we want to look at these people on Medicaid and make sure they can't work. And if they can work, we're going to put them to work. And I just despair. But what is the opinion of the panel about this? Is it just a lot of hot air, or are they really going to go through the Medicaid population and put people to work? Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Hi, I'll jump in. One thing that did happen in the amendment that to the AHCA that happened on Monday that we've been talking about, specifically limited to the county cost shift, other amendment or other changes got in, and one of the changes did allow an option for states to require work as a condition of eligibility for the non-disabled, non-elderly, and non-pregnant Medicaid enrollees. As of October 1st, 2017. It's a pretty wide list of what that means as far as what work activities means. And so that does include looking for work or actively seeking work. But that is something that the states can decide for themselves. I'll also add that there is also the requirement that the states will have to redetermine eligibility for Medicaid every 6 months. And so just to build on what your question was kind of touching on is the complexity and difficulty of maintaining the coverage and ensuring that it's appropriate for you. I've worked with people, my own mother in one example, to apply for Medicaid, and it's incredibly confusing and challenging, and it's taxing on anyone to figure out that process and navigate that environment. So that's another piece that adds to the complexity of Medicaid coverage.
All right, let me grab Dave and Webster on the line. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi. I was listening earlier, and I had to turn off my radio. The question I have is apparently there are big tax savings for some wealthy individuals that are going to come out of the Trump health plan. And I'm curious, how does that work, or why are tax savings there for wealthy individuals? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Dave.
So I can tell
Go
you
ahead,
about
Deb.
A couple of the tax savings that I noted. The one that I noted that seemed like it was really going to be very good for people who have a lot of unearned income is that you will no longer pay Medicare tax above a certain amount. They've removed various taxes on things like medical devices. I don't remember how the whole tax and tanning salons shook out in the end, but there were a whole series of taxes primarily were for wealthier individuals that were was supporting the subsidies for the ACA. Those have all been eliminated pretty much in this bill. So,
tax on tanning beds was eliminated.
It wasn't. We
still. Well, it's one of the ones that becomes removed. So there are several ACA taxes repealed effective January 1, 2017. Those include the ones that you had mentioned. It does include tax on tanning beds, tax on health insurers, on pharmaceutical manufacturers, an excise tax on the sale of medical devices. So there are several others as well.
I'm down to our last 2 minutes. So Karen Chakurji, what have we not covered that we should have? I mean, we've tried to cover a lot of ground here, mm-hmm. listener questions here, but mm-hmm. Outstanding going into tomorrow's vote?
I think one thing to think about that we haven't quite talked about yet is this issue of people who are young or just quote unquote healthy individuals and whether or not they'll have the incentive. I mean, this is from my perspective, a pretty big part of what may or may not unfold in terms of just whether or not those people are going to be part of the marketplace. And if they are, what kind of plans are they going to go for? Are they going to go for the plans where you have a really low premium and high deductible? And what is that going to do for other people who feel like they need health care every day? I mean, how is that going to unfold? Anybody have any thoughts?
Deb, Jane, yeah, thoughts on that? Deb, go ahead.
I honestly don't know. I mean, I think there's just a lot that we don't know. If I think back to when I was, 24 and invincible, and I didn't come out of college with the kind of student loans that kids are coming, young people are coming out with, I probably would try to find something for, I want to be covered if I get in a car accident.
Sure.
But I'll take my chances with getting strep throat and having to pay for a doctor's appointment. Not so sure that in the long term that's great for people's health and for preventive care.
Yeah.
Well, I think that we have to realize that most health care in the United States comes from employment and what employers provide. So if you're young and you may be invincible, But the fact is that if you're employed, you can get health insurance. So I really haven't seen any studies on this, breaking out people who are employed only part-time and don't get insurance, or people who aren't employed at all or in school. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a very interesting question.
Right. Jane, down to 20 seconds. Final thoughts from you.
Yep.
Go ahead.
We're going to really miss the marketplace so people can afford to retire early or take a part-time job because they now can get insurance. I know a couple of adjunct professors at community colleges who are now able to have insurance, and we're going to miss that.
Okay. Chris, final thoughts, 20 seconds.
Final thoughts. I would just encourage everyone to stay informed, continue to educate yourselves and participate on what the legislation is being proposed, and to have civilized conversation and debate with our legislators. And we're in a society now where it's easy to say hyperbolic stuff, but I encourage you to reach out, advocate for yourselves, but do it civilly.
Good stuff. Thanks to all of our panel. Sarah, thanks for jumping in on the phone with us this hour. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And our thanks to all the panel in studio. Karen Chakurji, great work for WXXI, and we'll look for much more of that. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, short break. More Connections is next.